Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Laura Feast and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is freight corridor programs. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have three presentations given by James Clarkin of Transport Canada, Tony First at the Federal Highway Administration Office of Freight Management and Operations, and Juan Jose Arazo Garcia Cano of Secretaria de Comunicaciones y Transportes. Sorry, my Spanish is a little rough, so I probably didn't get that quite right, but he can correct me later. James Clarkin is the manager for the Western Division of Transport Canada's Highway and Borders Group that manages federal funding programs in the four western provinces and the northern territories. His team consists of a dozen transportation engineers and environmental specialists focused on managing federal contributions to transportation infrastructure projects that are undertaken by provincial, municipal, or private sector partners. A good deal of the team's efforts now focus on projects that support the nearly 40 projects being advanced that support the Asia-Pacific Gateway and Corridor Initiative. James is a professional engineer and a certified management accountant, CMA, and has found a niche combining the two worlds of infrastructure and finance in his role with Transport Canada. Tony First is the director of FHWA's Office of Freight Management and Operation. He directs a multi-level staff which develops freight policy for the Federal Highway Administration, provides data analysis and decision support tools for transportation professionals evaluating freight projects, develops and promulgates professional capacity building programs and training for freight professionals, provides a truck size and weight program guidance and interpretation, and evaluates and promotes freight technology development for national and international deployment. Prior to joining the FHWA, Tony held a range of positions in the Department of Transportation with the Maritime Administration as a program coordinator, the Office of Secretary of Transportation's Office of Intermodalism as a regional coordinator for intermodal projects in the northeastern states and California, and the Transportation Security Administration as the branch chief of the Maritime Infrastructure Security Branch in the Maritime and Land Security Directorate. Juan Jose Arazo Garcia Cano has 16 years' experience working as the Secretaria de Comunicaciones y Transportes. Between 1992 and 2003, Juan worked in the General Planning Coordination in charge of different positions as the Director of Analytical Programming, Director of Regional Planning, Coordinator of Advisors, and Coordinator of Special Projects for the General Planning Coordinator. Since 2004, he has been in charge of intermodal and border projects. In his role, he leads and manages different projects related to the development of transportation, of highway transportation infrastructure in the United States-Mexico border. Currently, he is managing and developing the Northeast Infrastructure Package, which with an estimated cost of $3 billion. That includes the new construction of highways, rails, and international bridges, improvements of existing conditions, as well as implementation of an ITS system for the entire region. In addition, he is planning projects along the entire border region that includes negotiation with the U.S. and Mexico border states and other federal agencies. He's also in charge of other different studies to identify and search correctness of bottlenecks in different strategic transportation corridors, as well as the analysis of connectivity from the motor highway corridor with other modes of transportation such as maritime ports, ports of entries, airports, and international terminals. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for the audience question and answer. If during the presentation you think of a question, you can type it into the smaller text box underneath the chat area on the lower right side of your screen. Please make sure you are typing it into the text box and not the large white area. Please also make sure you send your questions to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and is a great forum for the distribution of information and a place where you can post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you have not already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I would like to remind you that this session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and visual portion of this seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend the seminar to access the recorded seminar. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next week. I will notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and the transcript of the seminar. We're now going to go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is freight corridor programs. Our first presentation will be given by James Clarkin of Transport Canada. As a reminder, if you have any questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they will be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. James?
Thank you very much, Laura. Most appreciated. And thank you for giving Transport Canada the opportunity to come here and speak as well. Gateways right now are a big initiative with us, and we're quite pleased to speak with and share ideas regarding our Gateway initiative. I think for my deck to pop up. Thank you very much, Laura. So what we've titled today's discussion on our end is Canada's Gateways. To get into our discussion on gateways, I'll have to give you a little background on the Canadian system and the Canadian programs, and then we'll jump into how we're dealing with what we call right now our gateway programs. Punch into the slides here. And I guess I can't ask you folks, but I hope my tone's okay and you can all hear clearly. So the presentation I'd like to deliver today, I'd like to talk briefly about the mandate of Transport Canada and why we're involved in the Gateway Initiative. Then I'll talk about Canada's national highway system, how we deliver our funding, and then discuss a little bit about the actual gateways we're considering. And the main focus will be on the Asia-Pacific Gateway Corridor Initiative that Transport Canada is pushing in. Main change for the Asia-Pacific trade. Okay, so Canada's highways, the federal role. Transport Canada's mission is to ensure there's a safe and secure and efficient transportation system in Canada. Now, we, very similar to the United States, do not own the highways. The highways are owned by the provinces here. So, though we have a mandate to support the system, we actually are not the owners and we're not the proponents. So, there has been extensive history of federal funding of highway projects over the past 80 years, number of different agreements, different mechanisms, be they contributions or grants. So there is that history that's there, and it's definitely continuing. But the question is, how do we deliver that? One of the initiatives that has come to our forefront is we have the story. The National Highway System is a system that was developed by Canada because we do not have control over what we call the Trans-Canada Highway. Now, those of you in Canada, we use the Trans-Canada routes, and that's primarily the primary east-west routes. However, the designating of a Trans-Canada Highway is done by the provinces. So, don't have much say on what is going to be a Trans-Canada. So, what has been developed with consultation with the provinces and agreement is the National Highway System. And that is a network of highways across the country that basically are the key connectors for major centers, key connectors with border points, key connections with ports, and other areas for trade and mobility. I'm just showing a brief map here, and I think you can all see my mouse. The main focus that I'll discuss a little bit later, just to give you a heads up, are for Asia-Pacific Gateway. It's two corridors here, Highway 16 up to the port of Prince Rupert, and of course the main port of entry is Vancouver along Trans-Canada Highway 1 into the heartland of the central area. The National Highway System, it is designated, as I mentioned, Trans-Canada is designated by the provinces. So in 1986, we launched an initiative to develop a national highway system, and that is essentially broken down into three categories. So we have our core routes, which are really the major connectors, the four-lane routes between centers. We have feeder routes, which are smaller, more regional roads that do connect into the national highway system, the core routes. And we also have northern and remote routes that are deemed essential, but simply do not have the traffic volumes or do not service the volume of trade or travel that would support being on the core system. And of the national highway system routes, the makeup is about 38,000 kilometers in the country. Now, that's only about 3% of Canada's total highways, but it actually carries about 30% of the traffic volume in Canada. So that gives a good idea of just how important the national highway system is to the country. And what this establishment of the national highway system has given us is given us a good direct avenue to provide funding because we can direct our funding towards national highway system projects when necessary. So that's a little background on our setup and how we often handle our programs. Now I'd like to discuss briefly the current initiatives underway in Canada. The Building Canada Plan. The Building Canada Plan is our largest infrastructure investment that we've ever launched here, and a total of $33 billion over the next 7 years. There have been a few additional announcements for infrastructure stimulus that bring that amount to even a little bit greater. Funding programs they vary from directed to flexible, and hearing in Canada over the past years from the provinces who actually own the highways that they need to have a more sustainable base funding amount that they can keep up with the rust out and the regular infrastructure needs. And so there's been a number of funds that are established that provide them that flexibility, a base fund, a provincial territorial base fund of $25 million a year, broken down per jurisdiction. So they can then use that money for their priorities. And then there's more directed funding. So the Building Canada Fund focuses on either major infrastructure that's strategic to Canada, and it covers wastewater as well as transportation, transit, broadband, sorts of initiatives. Then we move on even further in the spectrum to where we have very directed funding, and this is where our gateway funds are coming in, the first being the Asia Pacific Gateway Corridor Initiative, and that is a $1 billion fund to support to improve the networks of the Asia Pacific Gateway. And now we've actually added also the Gateway and Border Crossing Fund, which will predominantly go to support the Atlantic Gateway and the Continental Gateway. So I'll move on a little bit here. So I just have a quick slide up here showing the gateways and the gateway concept. Now, we don't take full credit for everything here. There's been a lot of work done around the globe by other countries looking at gateways, and also with our provincial partners, particularly in British Columbia, looking at the gateway concept. And I guess the main way to think of the gateway, we view it, is the supply chain. And it's not about thinking about how do you fix the highway, it's how do you fix the highway and the rail and the port so that the holistically everything functions a little bit better. Here we're showing kind of the zone of influence for the, on the left side of the by the Asia Pacific Gateway, and that is what we're going to focus on a little bit later. And of course the newer initiatives, the Ontario-Quebec Continental Gateway, which will be a good deal of that will be improving the Windsor-Detroit crossing, and there's going to be an awful lot of people involved in that initiative right now and an awful lot of money going into Detroit. And, of course, the Atlantic Gateway as well, which will involve a lot of ports and rail access and other infrastructure. So I'd like to speak a little bit about the Asia-Pacific Gateway, and that's kind of where we'll focus now, get into a little bit more of the details of our presentation. As I mentioned earlier, Asia-Pacific is a $1 billion initiative to strengthen the Asia-Pacific Gateway, and the lion's share of the investment is going into infrastructure. I believe it's above 95% going into the actual hardcore infrastructure. And that infrastructure is generally located along our two main corridors that lead to the two western ports. Prince Rupert, sorry, I should back you up a little bit to the slide. You can see a little bit here. Prince Rupert is the port in northern northern British Columbia. And Highway 16 leaves Prince Rupert and follows in through Edmonton, Saskatoon, and down to Winnipeg in here. I missed a province there. And Highway from the port of Vancouver, Highway 1 follows in from Vancouver through the Rockies into Calgary, Regina, Saskatchewan, and then Winnipeg as well. So the Highway 1 and the Highway 16 corridor, both road and rail, are generally the focuses of the Asia Pacific. Now, the other part of Asia Pacific is that goes along with the infrastructure, and it's just as important, is the non-infrastructure side. There is a good amount of money that's going into non-infrastructure initiatives, and that's basically designed to engage stakeholders, to talk to the shippers and to talk to the ports, a number of trade missions to get the word out overseas on what the Asia Pacific Gateway is, how we're improving it, how we're making things better for shippers and for people bringing Canada. It's also to develop and foster cooperation with different partners along the route. We're trying to get everyone involved. We've often got times when we've got rail and port folks funding projects that have common benefits. And one of the biggest things is to identify issues and to identify solutions to current problems. We definitely be glad to elaborate further on the non-infrastructure side of the Asia Pacific Gateway initiative. I think we could do a presentation on that subject 10 times over. In fact, a number of my colleagues have been touring the globe, giving discussions on Asia Pacific. You may have had a speech from Brian Bohanicki or Mr. John Higginbotham of our offices, and we would be definitely willing to provide more information on that initiative if you wish. But I'd like to talk now about the infrastructure side, though, the projects. So we have essentially a $1 billion fund for infrastructure, and that's big for us on our scale. It's one of our bigger programs, and we went out to see what we could do to make those two key networks, the two key links from Prince Rupert and from Vancouver, make them better. So through a number of studies, we identified who were the likely proponents, and we went out with a call for proposals open to both public and private entities to see if they had any infrastructure projects that would support the Asia Pacific Gateway. We established an eligibility criteria and terms and conditions, of course, that were vetted by our Federal Treasury Board, and those became basically the rules of the program, and then we asked that proposals be submitted to how the projects measured up. We had an initial screening of the projects just to make sure that there wasn't anything that really just did not fit, and we weren't, and that way we could screen out proposals and not waste people's time if it didn't really fit. And then we had a full proposal submission for each of the projects. And that was reviewed at Transport Canada by a mixed team of experts here, both technical and policy folks, and also had a strong regional presence as well. So we had a good group that brought different things to the understanding of the gateway evaluating these projects. The projects were evaluated based on a number of criteria, including how the project, of course, supported the Asia Pacific Gateway, a benefit-cost argument. Of course, we weren't looking to do anything that didn't make fiscal sense. The project had to remove a bottleneck along that gateway, that supply chain, and we're also looking to leverage projects. So we wanted to see that Canada generally provides 50% funding contribution to these projects. When proponents were looking for less than 50%, we saw that as favorable as well, that people were putting something on the table as well to support the project. So from the evaluation of these proposals, and I believe we had 20 to 25 proposals that were submitted. We submitted a recommendation to the minister, and since I believe the first announcements came in May 2007, as far as the proposals, and I'll just flip you ahead to the next slide to sort of show you where we're at as far as projects go. I apologize, it might be a little tough to read the map, but I think it gives a good indication that we have awarded, there's roughly about 40 projects that are out there now, and the reason it's written that way is we say 40 projects because we count some of the programs that I'll speak about later as individual projects. So we have a number of projects that are on the Highway 16 corridor from Prince Rupert down to Winnipeg. And we have a number of projects as well. Strong focus in the lower mainland of BC, where the Port of Vancouver is our busiest port on the West Coast, of course, and through the Superior Corridor of Highway 1 into Winnipeg as well. But we've got, we were able to get a good mix of projects. Some are big, some are small. We have projects in the hundreds of millions. We have only $1 billion project right now, where we're contributing a good chunk. And we also have a number of small projects. Intersection improvements in very industrial areas in Vancouver. Have rail projects. We have some port work. We have, of course, a number of highway projects. And one of the things we're very excited about is we have also some short sea shipping initiatives. And that is essentially, for those not familiar with the concept, we have a lot, number of inland waterways on the West Coast, including the Fraser River. And in this case, when the container ships come to the dock at Roberts Bank, they now can, we're looking to see if, instead of taking the containers off and driving them up into the where the rail yards are, we could then ship them on barges up the river. So it's a way of getting container traffic off the roads. And it's also a little bit of a more green transportation mode. So we're funding a few short sea shipping projects as well. I know I'm running a little tight on time, so I'll just briefly get into some of the key projects that we've highlighted that we're funding. The first one would be the Roberts Bank Rail Corridor. Now that travels through the lower mainland, British Columbia. On the far left here is Roberts Bank, and this is one of the main container ship area on the West Coast. And the red line is the rail line that cuts through now these very, very well-established communities in the lower mainland, and then connects into the more national rail network. There are a number of communities here that are really choked by this rail line when it's busy. So we've got the issue that we can't really add rail traffic, because we've got a number of at-grade crossings that really do choke the citizens off. So this initiative, and there's a fair bit of Transport Canada leadership here, brought together a number of the municipalities, the railways, the Port Authority, the federal and provincial governments, to see how we could improve this line. And the study looked at how we could do grade separations along the line, close some crossings, add some grade separations, add some sidings to make this a much more workable rail line for both the cross traffic for people living in the area, and also to then allow for longer train traffic. So Canada is contributing $75 million to the initiative. It's valued at a little over $300 million, and there's 12 partners involved. So a really good example of how going out there with this focused Asia-Pacific initiative was able to bring a real big group together to attack one major bottleneck of the whole system. Another key project is the South Fraser Perimeter Road, which is also in the same area, and this is actually a new road. It's going to provide a 40-kilometer long connection from the Delta Port area and Roberts Bank area to the Trans-Canada Highway System or the National Highway System, and also to the new Golden Ears Bridge being built in Vancouver to get access to more of the areas. Canada is contributing. This is our biggest project and probably our showpiece. We're contributing $165 million total, and it's over $1 billion, this project. The province of British Columbia is the proponent. There's a number of challenges going through this area. There's a number of sensitive lands that are being considered, but it's a project for us that should provide a much-needed road connection between the ports and the highway system. Right now, if you know the lower mainland area, you're traveling basically on arterial street. Oops, sorry, I jumped the slide, and I am tight on time, so I'll go quite quickly here. The delivery model, how do we deliver these things? I just want to touch on this basically. Transport Canada, we of course are not the owners, the recipients or the proponents. Our partners that we work with build the projects and are responsible for getting the projects done and managing any cost overruns. Up front, Canada commits to a certain amount of funding, and we have to stay capped at that. And to ensure that, we enter into a contribution agreement, and we work with the provinces or the recipients to manage that contribution agreement. We also work with guide the recipients to the federal process, and then we're involved, of course, in monitoring the projects and reporting up and paying, of course, the claims. The most important part is returning the money. And then at the end of the project, we do an evaluation for the projects. When we do the evaluation, what we look at is we look at a retrospective evaluation to see if the outcomes were achieved that we wished. We look at accident stats, and we look at as much as possible trade values. Trade values are difficult to look at on a smaller scale for a smaller project. We think we'll have much better luck looking at sort of overall trade benefits of the program when we look at the larger level die evaluation. We generally try to do these retrospective evaluations, hope to do them a couple of years after the projects are completed, ensure that we allow time for the network to mature. However, it's often difficult to do that because of our contractual arrangements where we have to have everything completed at once. So as part of the APGCI, the non-infrastructure initiative will go a long way to give the networks and the projects some time to mature and take effect, and then we'll get a better look at how things have behaved. And then we will be having a program evaluation for APGCI to see, was it the right thing to do? Was it efficient? We'll talk with our stakeholders, and that is one of the biggest things we on the non-infrastructure side is we get out there and we talk to people and find out what is working and what is not working. Are we spending our money well? Is this a good initiative? Want to get this right. Then we'll also look at a number of indicators that we've developed and attempt to make a number of measurements both economically through surveys and such. That brings me pretty much to the conclusion of my presentation. I hope I've given you a good overview of what Canada's initiatives are right now. The Asia-Pacific Gateway is the first one out of the gate. We have to say largely due to the efforts of British Columbia in pushing their gateway program ahead. And the Atlantic Gateway and the Continental Gateway there's a number of studies underway, and we look for a number of announcements coming there in the near future. And so there's lots of excitement around these for Canada. We feel that it's a great way to direct policy initiatives to outcomes, and we also think we're tackling some real bottlenecks that are going to go a long way into our trade network and our highway network in the future. So I will open up I believe we're having questions at the end. So I'll now pass the call back to Laura as the leader and. Look forward to any questions at the end of the presentation.
Great. Thank you, James, and thank you for those of you that have posted questions. I'm just going to bring up, and please be patient with me. I'm a newbie, so I'm just learning the ropes. So if you're seeing a lot of things going on your screen that don't usually happen when Jen Simone's in charge, it's because I'm in charge today, and I'm goofing it up a little bit. So just give me a second to pull up Tony First's presentation for him, and then we will get started with Tony.
All right. I'll go ahead and get started. While Laura is doing that, good afternoon, everyone, and many thanks to all of you for signing on. What I'll be talking about is not exactly a corridor program at USDOT or Federal Highways, as much as it is the analytic background that we've put in place to take a look at corridors. From the very first FAF maps, the Freight Analysis Framework maps that I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with in 2000, a number of the key trunk lines were apparent. In the ensuing years, there has been an increased focus on freight and the vital role it plays in the national economy. What's also received an awful lot of attention is the transportation infrastructure that supports freight movement. In Safety Lou, that attention presented itself in a number of different programs. We had projects of national and regional significance, the National Corridor Infrastructure Improvement Program, the Intermodal Freight Distribution Pilot Grant Program, National Cooperative Freight Research Program, and the Freight Professional Capacity Building Program. All of those were put in place in Safety Lou, and I'm happy to say that the PNRS, the Projects of National and Regional Significance, final rule was published on the 22nd of October in 2008. So we now have the regulatory framework in place for that program should it be authorized in the next bill. In the lead-up to reauthorization, GAO went back through a lot of their prior work and distilled these key principles as those which should steer the reauthorization discussion. All of these need to be considered, of course, but it is the first one that I'll focus on. When you start using terms like national interest and federal role, you move toward the Constitution, and terms like national defense, international and interstate commerce come to mind. That concept, that connection, has played itself out in many of the reauthorization proposals being offered, both from the National Transportation Surface and Revenue Study Commission, the 1909 Commission, which recommended that we go from 100 plus programs down to 10 programs, with one of those programs being freight. Probably out of the gate before even that came about was ARTBA, the American Road and Transportation Builders Association, with their critical commerce corridors, their three C's. Since then, ATA, the American Trucking Associations, ASHTO, and AAPA, the American Association of Port Authorities, have all endorsed the concept of a freight program in corridors within the national network. Next slide. Kind of as we thought about interstate commerce and this corridor concept here in the department, can we broke it down into two key pieces, the connectivity piece and the corridors piece. And both of them are absolutely key to this discussion. You can't really talk about corridors without making sure that you have the connectivity from those corridors to all the places in the United States, or any country for that matter, that is going to be needing the freight that's coming off those corridors for their local communities. So this slide kind of represents the connectivity piece. I'll kind of walk you through it. The red that you see on the slide is the interstate, and it is also includes a lot of the national network and the national highway system. The national network for the U.S. is that portion of the highway system where trucks that are 102 inches wide and 48 feet long, or twin 28s, must be allowed to move. The green part that you see there is the national network that is not on the national highway system or not on the interstate. The states were left to their own discretion about how much they wanted to put on the national network, and as you can see from this, a number of states decided that many of their roadways needed to be part of the national network, and other states had just exactly the opposite perspective. The yellow part is the national network that is also on the national highway system. The national highway system is, of course, one of the funding programs within Federal Aid Highway Program. And basically the purpose of this slide is to demonstrate that there are a number of different ways of defining the system. And I didn't even put the longer combination vehicle routes as an overlay on top of this, which would have made it an even more convoluted and difficult slide to interpret. The point is, we've gotten to the place where we need to either rationalize, harmonize, or in some way come to grips with a number of these diverse systems to get them into some kind of focus as we move forward. Next slide. This slide is the freight flows by mode in 2002. It is by tonnage, and that big red blob that you see in the middle of the country really is the Powder River coal that's coming out of Wyoming to the mid-body of the United States. And when you look at it, you'll see a number of parallel routes that are both highway and rail. You can look at California through the up to the Texas Panhandle and on into St. Louis. You can look from California, Southern California, up to Salt Lake City. And you can look from the Pacific Northwest to Salt Lake City. Kind of along the lines of what James was talking about in Canada, we need to think about these corridors from a holistic perspective and think about the parallel highway and rail lines that are included. Go ahead and hit the next button. What comes up now are the metro regions in the United States, and these are the areas of large population centers that hold a lot of the population of the United States. The next slide, these red dots are all of the freight bottlenecks that Cambridge Systematics put together for a freight policy study for our policy group some time ago. As you can see from these corridors, they connect all of the major metropolitan hubs, one to the other, and provide the conduit between all of them. Next slide. So what we did is we started taking a look at the freight analysis framework and the data that we have, and we looked to connect all of the major metropolitan areas that in 2000 had populations of 1 million or more, and we looked to connect those to all of the ports, landside and waterside, that carry more than 1 million TEUs per year. And then we looked at actual tonnage flows and set the breakpoint at 50 million tons a year between all of those locations. And what you see is both the rail, the highway, the water, and the brown ones are both rail and highway together. To take a look at the highway piece, we took 50 million tons and converted it into truck trips, and it's about 8,500 truck trips a day on that portion of the interstate system. So it would be the annual average daily truck traffic of 8,500. So you can see all these connections. And the next slide, kind of what we did is we took all of those, the analysis that we'd done prior, and connected it with one day's travel time. So one day's truck travel time kind of connects all of these together. And this represents about 25,000 miles, predominantly on the interstate system. It is the minimum network necessary in order to connect all of the population centers of a million or more with all of the freight generators that handle about a million TEUs or more. Again, this is one way to look at corridors. It is not the official USDOT policy or position, but it is simply representative of the analytic work that we're doing here in the Office of Freight Management and Operations to take a look at how we could define corridors when the discussion gets to the point that we want to do that. Next slide. This is another way to look at corridors. What we did is we took the annual average daily truck traffic that we get from HPMS and a number of other locations and then compared that to the annual daily traffic. And what you see here is the break point between 10,000 and 25%. So the thin lines is annual average daily truck traffic of less than 10,000, and where those trucks represent less than 25% of the overall traffic stream. The green lines, less than 10,000 trucks a day, but those trucks represent greater than 25% of the average daily traffic stream. The orange lines, you're greater than 10,000 trucks, but you're less than 25% of the overall stream. And you'll see in most of those areas, it's around the large metropolitan areas where the passenger traffic kind of overwhelms the truck traffic in those areas. And the red lines is where you have more than 10,000 trucks a day, and it represents more than 25% of the traffic stream. So when you start looking at this, it gives you a way to think about where we can evaluate potential solution sets and how we can think about going forward and alleviating some of the congestion that we have on some of those roadways. The next slide gives a look at a number of comparable corridors, and I present this to you as a way of saying that not all corridors are created equally. We took three corridors that all have comparable tonnage and volume flows, and then started digging down into the length of the truck trips on those respective pieces of the network. And what you see is a very different dynamic underway. If you look up in the upper Midwest, you'll see that the vast majority of those trip lengths are less than 100 miles. Even though there may be parallel rail lines, the likelihood of those cargo trips, those truck trips, converting to rail are pretty slim. If you look down along the Mexican border there in Texas, you'll see that a vast majority of those trips are more than 500 miles. And in that case, there may be a potential to work with a parallel rail line to move those goods more efficiently throughout the United States. And then when you get up to I-40, it's kind of a mixed bag. And potentially there are some solution sets there. But the key piece to this is that there are a number of ways of looking at the network, and you need to drill down and understand the dynamics that are going on the ground with how the cargo is moving from origin to destination before you start thinking about potential solution sets to solve the problem. The next slide, we took a look at commodity flows, and we did this for the Department of Agriculture. They asked us where all the agricultural products were moving in the United States relative to the major freight flows in the United States. We can do this for all of the different commodities that we have within the freight analysis framework, and it gives you an idea to see how different economic sectors are utilizing the transportation network and where we could be placing some changes in, or some improvements into the system to kind of help move those goods across the system more efficiently. The next slide represents the corridors of the future. And I put this up because once you've started thinking about corridors and you think about the institutional framework that we have in the United States regarding how we look at transportation projects, you need to start thinking about multi-jurisdictional coalitions and ways to enable these types of institutional capacities to take place so that a number of states working together can think about corridors beyond the individual boundaries of their respective states. On the I-70 corridor, for example, they put in place the idea of a dedicated truck lane concept, and those four states have come together and signed a corridor development agreement and an MOU about how they are going to collaboratively work to think about putting in place a dedicated truck lane system if it turns out that the research proposal they currently have on the street determines that the dedicated truck lanes in that corridor are economically feasible. And then how they would go about prioritizing projects along the corridor, allocating funds, et cetera, from a multi-jurisdictional perspective, working collaboratively to think through how those projects would be advanced. This is kind of the next step in thinking about corridors. Once we've identified them and figured out how to fund them, then we need to put in place and think about the institutional arrangements that enable them to go forward. On the I-95 corridor, the I-95 corridor coalition is the one that's kind of working, the one from Maine all the way down to Florida. There's a smaller five-state one that works just in the southeastern states. But that is more an ITS component where they think about how they're going to put in place electronic tolling and kind of sync all of that up together so that you have a harmonious system that works all the way across the eastern seaboard of the United States. The last slide I want to put up is we thought about passenger movement as well as freight movement, and so we overlaid the high-speed passenger rail corridors that were developed by the Federal Railroad Administration under the National Freight Corridors, and it looks like a pretty tight fit. So not only are a number of those corridors major freight corridors in the United States, but they are potentially major passenger corridors as well. So when you think about these types of corridors, you can think about it from a number of different perspectives. And if you can sync up both passenger movement with rail movement, if you were to put in place high-speed passenger rail, for example, across any one of those corridors, you could significantly improve freight flows through those corridors because now you've pulled the passenger rail off the freight rail and freed up the freight rail to move more efficiently. So again, this is the result of a lot of analysis we have been doing and have conducted underway within Federal Highways, thinking about corridors and how we could define major freight corridors in the United States. We'll see what happens in the next reauthorization bill. But before I close, I do want to give special thanks to both Rolf Schmidt and Mike Sprung, both in the Office of Freight Management and Operations, for doing a lot of the analytic heavy lifting that made a lot of these maps possible. So with that, I'll conclude, and we'll turn it over to our representative from Mexico.
Okay, well, we do have one slight small change. We're going to have Manny Kwan give the final presentation. Juan was not able to make the call, so I just want to give a quick intro for Manny as I'm bringing up the presentation here, just so you guys know a little bit about Manny and what he does. In April 2008, Mr. Kwan was given an opportunity to work at the Secretariat of Communications and Transportation of the United Mexican States as Deputy Director of International and Interagency Issues. Some of his duties are to intervene in international negotiations of border infrastructure and bridges and border crossings in coordination with diverse agencies, companies, organizations, and the federal, state, and municipal levels. He also participates in binational meetings such as the Joint Working Group Committee proposing new border projects, developing binational studies and projects establishing priorities of construction, modernization of bridges, and international crossings. And he also promotes the agency's projects and programs through expositions and presentations in a diverse national and international forums. Here is his presentation. Prior to joining the Secretariat of Communications and Transportation, Mr. Kwan joined Smith Watson Company to serve as Executive Vice President of Transportation Consulting. He has also served as the political appointee in the Bush administration at the U.S. Department of Transportation. Now, we have your presentation up. Well, Manny, are you on the line for us? Manny? Give us just 1 second. We're going to track down Manny and make sure that he was able to connect in. He is dialing in from Mexico, so there's sometimes a little technical issues. So let's give him a second here.
Well, I tell you what, while we're waiting for Manny, you can start going through some of the questions, and we'll go ahead and get those knocked out early on.
Okay,
as soon as Manny signs on, we'll stop that and get back to the presentation.
Manny has joined the conference.
Hello.
There we go.
All right. Perfect.
Hello.
Hi, Manny.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. Thank you so much for stepping in at the last second here. I just quickly gave a quick bio. I'm not sure if you were able to hear us or not yet. We just introduced you a little bit, so you are ready to go with your presentation. It's ready to go. So please go ahead.
Thanks. And again, my apologies for Juan Jose. He wanted to be here, but unfortunately, last minute, he got pulled out to go to another meeting with the secretary. As you probably know, we have a new secretary in Mexico, and things are moving fast in here. But in any event, thanks for the introduction. I did not hear what you just said, but I'm sure it went well. Basically, freight corridor programs in Mexico, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you guys a quick introduction on where Mexico stands, and then I will give you a three-step strategy for binational transportation programs for Mexico. The North American region has an important strategy at world level. This region generates over 17 trillion dollars. And for the last 25 years, the average percentage of annual growth for international commerce is 6%. The Mexican international commerce is equivalent to 54% of its internal net product. 74% of Mexico's international commerce within the United States is about 74%. For the last 7 years, Mexican customs has been maintaining its process for international commerce and even gone up to 13% superior to that. Time and money for transferring along the border area has nearly gone up to 30% of its cost in exports for logistics. It is important to make the border more efficient, transparent, and secure, supported within a competitive economy by providing instruments or programs to expedite the process like the CTPAT, the FAST, and the Sentry. For example, in the CTPAT program, nearly 300 exporters are registered, and 41% of its total exports have done this job. Likewise, for the nearly 500 certified companies are registered for the FAST program, at least 40% of the imports and 71% of exports. In regards to the Sentry program, we have so far 165,000 users registered. That means 77% of the transport traffic is covered by this program. Well, as I mentioned to you guys, we will do a three-step strategy for binational transportation in Mexico. The first will be the development strategic corridor, and then the regional competitiveness, and then the third one will be the development of border infrastructure. Why develop a strategic corridor? We need to know the connectivities between the countries. Integrate strategic corridors with seaports, borders, and important cities. Of course, keeping in mind the secure and efficient operations at the border. The principal strategy corridors for Mexico is also well connected with the United States. In this slide, you will see our main axis or main corridors that include the seaports and the road ports. The projection for year 2020, the movements of trucks between Mexico and the U.S., we were able to merge the data from Federal Highway Administration and ours, so you can have a better visual axis where the truck traffic is moving to and from. This is just a quick example on the quality of the infrastructure rated in 2006 at the Economic World Forum. As you can see, Mexico is rated on 49, and we are 3.8, which is the average is at 3.7. Exports between Mexico and China to the United States. We were competing with China up to year 2001. As you can see on this slide, China took off rapidly and left Mexico behind. Here, the situation in 2006, basically we show our basically average daily traffic with. We needed to make sure that the Mexico takes an inventory on what we have in our corridors. So this is our analysis on traffic, and this is our connections. Oops, those didn't show. Sorry, guys. This is our what we wanted to connect to and from. The second part is the strengthening regional competitiveness. What we decided to do is we wanted to connect for the year 2012 the interregional corridors to our main corridors. And again, these are projects that we are working on to be able to complete and have it more easy for the traffic. And of course, including our secondary, this slide includes our secondary and interregional corridors. Now, for the development of border infrastructure, here we in Mexico, our federal agency, we decided to view it in two different directions. The first one to your left is the modernization of existing ports. How? Well, we wanted to widen the infrastructure, add express lanes, and modernize access. And the last and the most creative ones to implement ITS technology into the port. On the other hand, we need to build new ports with public and private investment, in which we have about four new projects working on it. For example, the San Luis Rio Colorado in Arizona and Sonora, and Rio Bravo Donna, which is in the state of Tamaulipas and Texas, and we're almost completing the Ansaldúas Bridge also in the state of Tamaulipas and Texas. We're in the process of working with the Mesa del Tight 2, which is in the state of Baja California and California, and of course in Chihuahua and El Paso area, the Guadalupe Tornillo project, and last but not least, the railroad project, the first railroad, well, not the first one, but the last project that Mexico had done, a international crossing, was over 100 years ago. So this will be our first project with public and private investment. The daily average wait time in selected ports in Mexico and Canada, as you can see with the purple line in years 2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006, Canada can maintain or actually lower their wait time from 9.3 minutes to 7.2. What happened to Mexico? It went worse. And as you probably know, in September 11, it was a major factor for the United States. And we need to learn from the Canadian agencies, or at least the Canadian border, on how to make it more efficient, more transparent, and more easy for everybody to cross. Here's just an example of the daily average wait time at some of the ports in Mexico. As you can see, all of them have gone up and even passed beyond the wait time. As you see in Laredo, we are about half an hour, 35 minutes wait time. And the next slide gives you an idea on the inspection range between 2000 and 2006 by CBP in different modes of transportation. We would like to see on the maritime, which is the green line, it's very constant, and the motor carriers. You can see the difference in the blue line, which jumps up to 80% of the inspection. That's a little bit too much for what we think it is. In regards to the region, why we decided to focus on the border, this slide will give you a percentage on selected ports of entry on the millions of tons that crosses our border. And the next slide will show you why it was determined by our agency to concentrate on those focus points. It's not made up by politics, but it's just depending on the millions of tons crossed. And we broke those areas into eight different areas. The first one will be Tijuana, San Diego, Mexicali, Calexico, Nogales, Nogales, Ciudad Juarez, El Paso, Piedras Negras, Eagle Pass, Nuevo Laredo, and Laredo, Reynosa, McAllen, and Matamoros, Brownsville. The reason we chose to do it by region is because we did not want to exclude any of the ports of entry that there were in that area. For example, in Reynosa, McAllen, as most of you guys know, there's a set of bridges that we analyze those as a system of bridges, not a single port of entry. For example, the Hidalgo Bridge and then Saldúa's Bridge and the FAR Bridge, we wanted to make sure that the system works as the traffic flows smoothly and not individually as a port of entry. This next slide gives you an annual average daily truck traffic at those eight principal regions with the maximum capacity. As you've probably seen, is we already have gone over the maximum capacity for those ports. This one also shows you the percentage of saturations at those different ports of entry. This is the example that I was mentioning to you earlier in regards to the system of bridges, not an individual port of entry. We wanted to make sure that every bridge is connected, and it's our duty and job to make sure that the flows goes smoothly through those areas. And with that, I think I'm done with the slide presentation. I'm sure there's quite a few questions and answers. I'll be glad to answer any of those that you might have.
Well, thank you, Manny, for stepping in, and that was a very interesting presentation. I'd now like to start off the question and answer session with the questions posted online, and once we get through those questions, if time allows, I'll open up the phone lines for questions.
Okay.
PDF slide.
And just real quickly, I'm going to show a slide for Tony, so I'm just going to
What I did while Jennifer, screen. I mean, excuse me, while Laura is putting this up, I'm so used to having Jennifer sit over there. We took a look at the slides that Canada gave us and that Mexico gave us, and then put together one slide that shows all of the corridors from the three nations together in one North American look. And so that's what will be up on the slide as we kind of go through the questions. So as soon as Laura gets it up, we'll be good to go, and then you can start walking through. There we go.
So hopefully this is showing for some of you guys. It's just taking a few minutes to load.
There we go.